very much. It's really great to be at the Fields Institute. I'm normally at the crummy building up the street, but you guys have it nice here. I'm going to talk about granular systems, and the real work in this experiment was done by graduate students, of course, Zeyna Khan, Wayne Takaruk, and a master's student who finished a few years ago, Cam Chu. Zeyna is here for detailed questions. And as I say, I'm from the Department of Physics, which is just past the smokestack up the street. Okay, I thought since I'm apparently the only person at this meeting talking about granular problems, I thought I'd spend a few minutes talking about what granular problems are and why they're interesting. When I say granular system, I mean sand or gravel or something like that. And its characteristic is that it consists of discrete macroscopic particles which have dissipative interactions. Basically, they don't interact at all, and so they bang together. And then energy is lost in that, either by friction because they rub on each other or just from the inelasticity of their collisions. So you should think of heaps of gravel or coal or grain or something like that. And what we would like to do, of course, is not analyze these problems by trying to understand where the motion of every single grain is. That seems to be kind of the hard way to go. What we should do probably is look for some kind of differential equations, and this is a meeting about differential equations, which describe these things in some kind of average continuum sort of way. And what's interesting about granular systems is that there really is no well-agreed upon differential equation which covers granular systems in all of their manifestations. And it probably never will be, okay? So there's no Navier-Stokes equation that you can fall back on for granular systems. And that kind of makes them interesting because in different regimes you have to deal with them using, new ideas and different types of models. You can't just sort of write down the be-all, end-all model and solve it, or even solve it numerically. So, for example, if you go to the dense limit where you have your grains close together as those that gravel was in the previous picture, and you ask, what happens if I kind of put a shear on this thing as if it was some kind of plastic solid, you get a very interesting result. And this is an experiment. This picture behind here is an experiment by Dan Howell in the group at Duke. It's basically a couette cell. You rotate the center thing, and you ask, how does the stress in this packed bunch of grains make it to the outside of the thing? And it doesn't traverse the intervening grains by any simple way. It goes via these things called stress chains, and each of these little bright things is through a visualization technique shows which grains are carrying all the stress, and so you get this amazing kind of lightning crackling pattern. Okay. So if you want a continued description of how stress is transmitted in a pile of sand, you have to figure out how to average over this very, very complex micro structure of these stress chains. So if you pour a pile of sand or coal or something and you ask how much of the total weight of the pile is each grain carrying, you find that a minority of the grains are carrying all of the load and everybody else is sort of riding for free. And that's sort of how the university system works, right? There's some of us who do all the work and the rest of them just ride along, right? The trick is to be one of those guys and not one of the... So the problem is that you'd like a continuum description, but intrinsically the fluctuations are huge in this system, so averaging and statistical physics of this is hard. And so there's no basic agreement on how to handle that. So you might say, well, that's the hard limit. They're all packed together. Let's go to the obvious easy limit. Let's say they're really dilute and fluidized, so they're very far apart from each other, and they only have collisions ever so often, right? It turns out if you do the theory of gas dynamical theory a la Maxwell for grains that have dissipative interactions with each other, you can derive everything. You can derive Navier-Stokes and all this sort of stuff. And what you find is a kind of strange sort of gas dynamics where even simple laboratory flows like, pouring the cereal out of your cereal box turn out to be, in fluid mechanical terms, very extreme. Okay, so here's a beautiful experiment done by Aaron Rarica in Austin, and you're going to see a lot of pictures from Austin here because I was on sabbatical there, and they also do a lot of granular experiments. But all it is it's a sort of two-dimensional wedge, and you fluidize some little tiny ball-bearing-like things, and you dump them down there, and they fall down under their own weight and bounce off the wedge and sort of flow past it, right? You do fast visualization of that, you get the velocity, the temperature, everything you want by directly visualizing those grains. And when you turn this into fluid mechanical terms, you find that you actually get shock waves here. This little flow is actually a Mach 40 or a Mach 50 flow. The speed of sound is so low that even rather modest laboratory flows, only falling, a short distance, turn out to be hypersonic. Okay, so this is something to think about when you're pouring your Wheaties into your bowl in the morning, that what you're actually making is a hypersonic flow in this granular, stuff. Another interesting feature of them is that they refuse to remain homogeneous. You start with a Maxwell gas, you know, with elastic collisions, you know that you get all sort of thermodynamic properties. If you turn on even a small amount of inelasticity, and this is actually a lot of inelasticity, and then just sort of let the thing go, the gas will spontaneously cool because the energy is being removed by collisions, but it will also order. So this is something called inelastic collapse, and clustering happens, so the gas quickly becomes inhomogeneous. Okay. Now, we're supposed to be talking about pattern formation, so it turns out that patterns abound in granular experiments. Here are some very famous experiments by the Texas group. You take a electromagnetic device called a shaker, which is essentially just a big speaker which wiggles its plate up and down, and you put a little pile of grains on there, maybe 10 grains deep or so, and you shake it up and down, and it spontaneously begins to slosh in these remarkable patterns, and these patterns resemble quite a lot the fluid patterns that you see. You're going to see lots of at this conference. Here's a square pattern. Here's a couple of different kinds of hexagons. Here's something that looks just like straight convection rolls or stripes or something. And here's my favorite, which is spiral defect chaos. That's what's on the back of the sweater, right? And it turns out that there's some slight differences. These are subharmonic, and they're not continuous like they are in convection. But essentially, you see all the same kind of symmetry breaking patterns that you know from convection. And of course, in nature, you see many beautiful patterns which spontaneously emerge in granular systems. This is a famous photo, or part of it, by Ansel Adams of a sand dune driven by the wind. And here's a slightly different scale. This is taken from space. And this is the Namibian desert from space. It has the largest sand dunes in the world, and the spacing between those things is about a kilometer. In the previous picture, it's about this big, 10 centimeters or so. So there's patterns everywhere. And in particular, the thing I'm going to talk about is something called segregation. This is where you take a mixture of big grains and small grains, or in general, grains that are just different from each other, and you subject it to some kind of flow, and it does something that's sort of surprising, which is that it refuses to mix. It actually unmixes. Okay? And this is a terrible problem in engineering. If you're ever trying to mix dry, you know, cake mix together or something, you find that no matter how much you stir it, it just gets worse and worse. Okay? And that's because the grains actually will spontaneously segregate most of the time. And this happens all the time in geology and in earth science sort of problems. And so we're going to talk about a very sort of idealized situation where you take a long tube and you partially fill it with a mixture of grains which are big and small. And in all the things I'm going to show you, the big grains are going to be white. And we use table salt or glass spheres, and they're around half a millimeter in size. And the small grains are going to be this stuff called hobby sand that you buy for your kid to dump into the glue, you know, to make sand pictures. And they're all going to be black, and they're roughly half or a third the size of the other ones. And you start turning the tube at some frequency, which is about one rotation per second or so. And another obvious parameter is how much you fill the tube. We use about a third. And a somewhat less obvious parameter that we've also explored is the composition fraction. So rather than putting in half white and half black, I'm going to show you lots of data for two-thirds white and one-third black. And for reasons that you'll see, that turns out to be important. Now, the nice thing about this experiment is that you can do it live and in color, and here it is, right here. Okay, don't turn the lights on, because I'm going to turn the video camera on in a second. So all it is a little synchronous motor that you can buy for $2 at Active Surplus on Queen Street, a mixture of sand and salt in a tube about 1 inch in diameter, and it's turning, you know, about once per second. And if I turn on the video camera, you'll see that the sand is continuously streaming down the front of the pile. And what's going to happen after about 5 minutes or so is that this stuff's going to spontaneously segregate into stripes along the axis of the tube. And that's called axial segregation. And that's the pattern that I want to focus on. Okay, so I'm going to leave that running and we'll come back to it. Zainab, you want to go be the person who does that? Okay, and so since demonstrations sometimes don't work, I brought a little movie in PowerPoint or in Keynote here. This is what you're going to see speeded up over 60 times. So what you see is some sort of little shadows blow around a little bit, and then they begin to organize themselves. And so this compresses, 10 minutes into 10 seconds. And pretty soon it's these stripes appear, and they eventually go to 100% segregation. They're absolutely black, okay? And again, the black ones are the small ones, and the white ones are the big ones. Okay, now, this is a nice experiment, but you can never do the same experiment twice because you can never really mix the initial conditions perfectly. So what we actually do is we use a U-channel, which is a little piece of aluminum. Here it is right here, actually. It's a little piece of aluminum, and you put the grains in there, and you carefully mix them in there, and then you stick that in the tube like this, and you dump them in, and you take it out again. Because if you just pour the grains in the tube, they segregate so much that you can't actually do the experiment that way. Okay, so what causes the segregation? Well, this I'm sorry to say I'm not really going to answer this question, but I'm going to give you lots of things to think about, I hope. One thing that's known is that almost always, or probably always, there's a second kind of segregation which happens first. Before you've got the stuff going along the axis, you get what we call radial segregation. And what happens there is some, or maybe even all, of the smaller particles move toward the axis of rotation. So if you stop the tube and dig underneath the surface, you find that it's not homogeneous anymore. So somewhere near the middle of the thing, there's a layer of, in this case, the black ones, which are small. And I'm going to come back to that and show you that a bit later. But this has been known for a long time. And the question is whether radial and axial are connected with each other or not. But we do know that radial segregation tends to occur rapidly because it involves grains that just have to move into the pile toward the center. Axial segregation requires them to move, you know, up and down the tube, which takes a lot longer. So it takes hundreds of tube rotations. Okay, it's also been known for a long time, and it's obvious to the eye, that the surface shapes of the different concentrations are different. And here is a picture taken by a summer student, Simon-Philippe Breton, in my lab. And it's basically looking at the tube from the end, if you like. And if you fill it with 100% salt or white stuff, you see it streams this sort of smooth shape. And the 100% black sand, it streams with this slight kink in here. So there's actually a concentration-dependent slope or even surface shape. And there's a question about whether that surface shape, we're going to come back to that too, whether the surface shape is important, the concentration dependence of it. Early ideas about this, which go back about 20 years or so, tried to explain the axial segregation by saying that for some reasons, which are complicated to explain, the what you would normally expect to be a diffusive process becomes a diffusive process with a negative diffusion constant. Okay, so I call this the negative diffusion model, and you can read about it in this paper. But the negative diffusion, negative linear diffusion equation is completely horrible, ill-posed. You know, I don't have to tell you guys that it just doesn't work. Things blow up, okay? So the whole thing is to try and make that work, and there's a lot of arguments and discussion about that. But so basically, people had an idea that this had something to do with diffusion, some kind of pathological diffusion, and that, therefore, that it was a first-order-in-time kind of process. It was just diffusion gone crazy. Okay, if you want to turn the video camera back on, Zaina, we'll have a look at the... Okay, let me open the aperture a bit here and focus a bit. Okay, so we have some bands down here. There's one. Let me see if I can... Oh, I'm getting a little bit of static here because your air conditioning is so good compared to ours. Okay, so there's one that's... Its center is essentially 100% black, and as time goes on, that'll grow a little bit, but... On the time scales we're going to be talking about, it won't change anymore. It won't get much bigger. Okay, I'll let it run for a bit longer. Yeah, so why you should think about this is the grains are essentially in solid body rotation, although there's some shear, right? And then when they get to the surface, they slip suddenly down the front face, and then they go around again. Okay? So this actually combines the fluidized and packed regimes, and they sort of, you know, one grain experiences both as it goes around. Okay, let's go back to the other one. Okay, so we approached this problem because I saw I thought this was something that you could probably do a nice experiment on. And so what we did was we made a tube like this, and we took a video image of the streaming surface, and we averaged it over a little bit over time, a little bit over space, and we stacked those images up in what I call a space-time diagram. T equals zero is at the top, so this is the length of a tube here, and we use a long tube, a meter long and about an inch in diameter. And then you can watch the thing evolve over as a function of time, and this is time going out to about 900 seconds. That's around 1,000 tube rotations or so. And you can watch the whole process occur, and by the time you get to the ear, you've got a few saturated bands down here. So this is pre-mixed random initial conditions as well as we can make. And this is a 50-50 mixture. In other words, this mixture fraction is one half. And then you immediately see things which make you begin to suspect that this negative diffusion idea is not right. That would be an irreversible separation kind of equation, and yet we see not only this merging of bands, but also splitting. It's a bit hard to see on this projector, but there's a splitting band here, and there's even bands that appear and disappear, and there's a lot of stuff going on in here. So by the time you get down here, the dynamics is rather stopped, but in the transient, there's a lot of activity. And so what we did was we analyzed the spectrum of the stripe pattern that you see as it becomes saturated for a 50-50 mixture, this is, for random premixed initial conditions. And this is what you find. And I put all these things in physical units because we don't really know how to scale this problem into dimensionless units, so we don't try, okay? So everything's in millimeters and so on. So here's the wavelength in millimeters, and here is the average Fourier power over many different runs. And what you see is a couple of striking things. One is that short wavelength structures are very suppressed. You basically don't see anything below about 30 or so millimeters, and that's approximately the diameter of the tube, okay? So that tells you that things, you know, little tiny stripes that are smaller than the diameter of the tube are mixed away, or at least that's what you would guess from that. And another sort of intuitively nice thing happens, which is that there's a peak where you see most of the Fourier structure, which is at around twice the tube diameter, okay? And that kind of makes sense, too. It's neither too, it's the Goldilocks principle, right? It's neither too long nor too short. The mode that grows couldn't be, you know, long, as long as the tube, because that would involve transport over long distances. But it can't be too short either. So with some kind of happy medium is the one that's going to be what you see. And indeed, that's what you do see. There's a long tail out here, and I wouldn't put anything on the structures. You know, this is not a significant variation out here. There's a long tail out here. So it's somewhat selective as far as wavelength goes, but it's not perfectly selective because there's a lot of Fourier power out here. And then my student, Kiam Chu, did a very interesting experiment. He needed to calibrate the grayscales of the camera. We wanted to know what grayscale of the camera corresponded to what concentration of actual grains. So he loaded the tube instead of with 50-50. He loaded it with two-thirds, one-third, so two-thirds white ones, so for a phi of 0.66. And then we did the same experiment as the one I just showed you, where we take a space-time image of random initial conditions. And when he showed me the data, it was immediately apparent that this transient was different than the transient that we normally saw. Now, maybe you can't see it, and this, I agree that you have to be kind of a true believer to see this, but you see there are structures in here that are moving laterally down the tube, right? It's more obvious in a non-projected version. But these sort of black and gray ripples down here in the transient do not look like the ones we saw before. Now, this experiment is terrible because you're mixing up this stuff that doesn't really want to mix, and you're producing fluctuations in your initial conditions over which you have no control. And then you're sticking it in a tube and amplifying whatever crazy fluctuations you have left in there, which you didn't control. So you can never get that pattern that I showed you twice. You can do it over and over again in new statistics, but you can never really control the initial conditions by trying to mix the grains up. Okay? So my philosophy of it is whenever you have an impurity in your experiment, then, and you can't get rid of it, what you should do is add more and call it a dopant, okay? Then you control it. So what our philosophy was then to start with a pre-segregated initial condition. So in other words, to try and swamp the random little fluctuations in the pre-mixed conditions with a signal that we controlled and see how the system responded to that signal. Okay, to accomplish that, we invented the little gizmo which separates the little U-tube into little volumes, and you load alternate volumes with black and white sand, then you stick it in and turn it over and dump it out again, and that effectively loads the tube with a 100% segregated stripe pattern where you choose not only the wavelength of the stripe pattern but also its composition fraction. Okay? Now, this, of course, still has fluctuations in it, but they're much smaller, hopefully not that big, compared to the large amount of segregation that you've loaded the tube with. Okay, so let me show you what happens when you do the same experiment as I just showed you with pre-segregated initial conditions. Now you see a very clear standing wave as a decaying transient. Now this is a bit different experiment because the initial pattern here has a large amount of segregation in it because it's pre-segregated. Okay, so these waves are a lot stronger to start with. Okay, but you see this is a standing wave because it has node lines. There's one, there's one, there's one. And so it's a stripe pattern, and then it comes up, it goes away, and then it comes back up as a stripe pattern, which is shifted over, okay, and then it goes away, and it comes back, and it oscillates four or five times, and then it kind of gets mixed up, and then this longer wavelength appears. I should say, well, I'm going to show you this data in a second, but this is a rather short wavelength. I didn't write the wavelength down, but it's like 20 millimeters or so. It's much shorter than the wavelength of the spontaneous bands that are stationary that appear later. Yes, the top surface. The top surface. It's in fact the whole top surface averaged over the width of the surface, okay, and then stacked up.
So
Oh, no, I forgot to say that. This is 2,000 seconds, and each rotational tube is only 1 second, right? So the period of this oscillation is hundreds of tube rotations. So this is slow dynamics compared to the tube rotation. Yes. Well, okay. I mean, hold that thought. You'll see where we go with this. Okay. Okay. So now you can, rather tediously load the tube with mixtures of different composition and wavelength, and just explore the response of the system to these different perturbations. And what you find is that the speed of the traveling waves, which you can get from analyzing that, the standing wave pattern is equivalent to two traveling waves which pass through each other left and right. If you think of those as traveling waves, you can get their velocities, and those with the dark spots are the pre-segregated initial conditions. You can also take pre-mixed initial conditions and look at space-time diagrams and occasionally pick out spontaneous traveling structures whose velocity you can measure by measuring the slope in space-time, and that's what those open symbols are. And what you find is that for wavelengths that are shorter than that cutoff wavelength of about 50 millimeters or so, they travel, and they travel faster and faster the shorter they are. But they also decay, because I showed you that those perturbations are on the low side of that peak, and they all are destroyed later. If you put in a pre-segregated wavelength larger than the peak in that thing, it's happy, and it just stabilizes at that stripe pattern and doesn't change. Okay. Now, the kicker is, if you do this as a function of composition, and you do it at 50-50, you see no traveling waves at all. If you do it at two-thirds, one-third, its data is kind of messy, but it's over here somewhere, and you see a traveling wave velocity, which very roughly depends on how far away you are from 50-50. Nobody has any idea why this is true, but it's true. So what we see again is basically oscillating structures on one side of the cutoff and stationary ones on the other. Okay, so along come the theorists. Negative diffusion can't explain traveling waves. There is no diffusion equation, no matter how you mess with it, that can explain traveling structures. That can have waves that travel up and down the tube in opposite directions, which we can show are actually like linear waves. They pass right through each other without amplitude disturbance and things like that. You need at least second order in time dynamics to get anything like a wave. Okay, I hope you agree with that, because I believe that. Okay, so you can't get this with Berger's equation or something like that. Okay, so very smart theorists, Igor Aronson, Lev Simmering, and Valerie Wienerker, sat down and said, well, we just need more equations, which is what theorists always say. And what they came up with was the idea that this was basically a diffusive problem, but there are more variables than we had thought. Okay. So what they do is they derive, and I use the word derive sort of loosely, they argue physically using geometric arguments and expansions and things, that there should be two coupled diffusion equations. So these two equations are basically first order in time and some variable in the axial concentration and the local streaming angle. Now, we know that the streaming angle depends on the concentration, right? So we suspect that the local streaming angle has something to do with the process. So what they do is they say, well, here's the concentration, and it's coupled to a flux which is driven by diffusion. So D is the diffusion constant. So this is a positive D, and so that will tend to destroy structures in the concentration just like diffusion should. So this is not a negative diffusion problem, not a negative diffusion model. Okay? And then they say, well, if there's a gradient in the slope, that will lead to gradients along the axis in the shape of the thing, which will drive fluxes, and they invent a concentration-dependent axial slope gradient flux. Okay, so this term will tend to drive the two species down gradients in the angle along the thing. And then they have a second diffusion-like equation for the slope itself, which has a source term which just gives you the concentration-dependent and rotation rate-dependent surface slope. And then there's slope diffusion, so the slope left to itself will smooth out diffusively with a positive diffusion constant. And then there's one more magic term, which is hard to justify physically, but you can sort of derive it from their argument. It's also the only coupling between C and theta, which is allowed by Z going to minus Z symmetry, and it's proportional to the gradient squared of C. Okay. So if you write this thing down, well, you have a kind of reaction diffusion equation, two coupled diffusion equations, so you have enough dynamics to get waves. And of course, if you know anything about Aaronson and Simmering, you know that they're able to come up with equations that give you any kind of process that you want. So what you can do is you can say, well, here's the uniform state. There's uniform solution C0, and it has this angle and that concentration. Let's do linear stability. We put in sinusoidal perturbations, linearize the equations. Here's what the eigenvalues do. Below some magic cutoff K, you get a positive real eigenvalue, but a zero imaginary part of the eigenvalue. So you have growing modes. And so this K here should correspond, if we could non-dimensionalize, we could dimensionalize this, it should correspond to the wavelength of the fastest growing mode, which should look something like the pattern that we see grow. But below this cutoff, or on the other side of this cutoff, you get decaying modes, because the real part is negative, but the imaginary part becomes positive and they oscillate. Okay? So you can even go, so this has a lot of parameters, but you can start messing with the parameters, and you can actually fit the dispersion relation of the traveling waves that we got experimentally. So this is omega versus K. I take that wavelength speed data that I showed you before and turn it into omega K, and I get those dots there. And they can take the dispersion relation from their theory with a bunch of parameters and actually fit it and show that they get, you know, a reasonable fit. Now, the trouble is there's lots of parameters, and most of them aren't known very well, but anyway, they fit. We didn't measure growth rates. Yes, in principle, yes. That's right. I think there's still too many parameters to nail down all of them experimentally. But let me show you what we did instead to demolish this theory, okay? It makes a very interesting and genuinely new prediction, okay? What it says is that there really are two dynamically active components, one the concentration and the other the dynamic angle. And they have a very special relationship to each other. When the oscillations are occurring, they must be pi by 2 out of phase with each other. So whenever there's a node line in the concentration, there should be an anti-node in the dynamic angle. And they should therefore be 90 degrees oscillating out of phase with each other at early times when there are small wavelength oscillations going on. Later, when the saturated bands appear, those are, you know, correspond to Fourier modes on the other side of the cutoff, and in that regime, they should be in phase with each other. Okay? So this is definitely a prediction. And in fact, it's actually a fairly generic thing. Whenever you have an oscillator, you typically need two variables which oscillate 90 degrees out of phase with each other, like position and momentum. And it's hard to come up with oscillations without something like that, right? So this is a prediction. They predict that the dynamic streaming angle should oscillate 90 degrees out of phase with the concentration. And we didn't measure this yet, okay? So we did. So we went away and did that. Yes. Now, in fact, the streaming slope is more than just a single angle. Experimentally, it's that shape that I showed you, okay? So, you know, what they do is they make a model where it just slopes all at one angle, okay? And that's a concentration-dependent and omega-dependent angle, okay? So what we do is we build this thing called a scanning profilometer, and here's the tube, and here is a video camera, a high-speed non-interlaced camera, which is looking at the tube obliquely, and here's a little laser pointer that we tore apart with a cylindrical lens in front of it, and you can't really see it, but it puts a vertical laser stripe on the surface of the grains here. The camera views that at an angle so that it can see a stripe which corresponds with some geometrical correction to the shape of the surface. Okay, so we can get the surface shape from taking pictures of that laser stripe. We can also get the local concentration because the integrated intensity of the laser stripe is proportional to whether the grains are black or white there. Now, to get this at each position axially, we put the whole thing on a translation stage. So this is a belt-driven translation stage. And what it does is it's kind of a supermarket scanner thing. It takes a bunch of pictures really fast here, moves a couple of millimeters down the tube, takes some more, moves a couple of millimeters down the tube, takes some more, and goes all the way down maybe 20 centimeters or so that way, and then retraces, goes zip, back to the beginning again, and then scans again. Okay. Now, the process is slow enough, and the profilometer can be made fast enough that we can actually build space-time images of this dynamic streaming angle and the concentration simultaneously. Okay? So it's, in principle, simple, but the hard part is to make it all work fast enough so that you don't miss something. I think I'm going to Okay, let's go back to the video for a second here, before I give you the punchline here. Okay, so now it's completely segregated, and I'm going to turn it off so that we don't wear out the grains, but you see there's black. Yes, that is the generally accepted thing, is that these will actually coarsen slowly over time. There's problems with doing that experimentally because the grains tend to grind and charge builds up and things go wrong. But there are people who claim that it coarsens forever until the tube is half black and half white. Okay. Okay, now the punchline. Here is the space-time picture of the concentration, now in false color. And these concentrations are not derived from photographs, but from the scanning profile technique. Here is the dynamic streaming angle simultaneous with that one. And the data is not as is not as high resolution because it's kind of hard to get the angles out, actually, because of the shapes and things. But I think you'll agree that this node line along here lines perfectly up with that node line along there. And this one lines up with that one. And that this one does not line up with that antinode. Okay, and even these two things have exactly the same correlation with each other as they do in these saturated bands later on. So there's no change from 90 degrees to in phase between the top and the bottom. And I can show that in the next picture, which shows on the right-hand side the experimental value of the phase difference between those two waves. You can get this from Fourier techniques. This is an expanded scale, so because of our sign conventions, that should be pi if they're in phase with each other all the time. This is like 2.8, and that's 3.5. And so within experimental resolution, there is absolutely no phase difference. They're all out of phase with each other by pi over all wavelengths. This is the wavelength. Okay? Theoretically, you can take the Aaronson-Simmering model, the full nonlinear model now, integrate it on the computer, and do the same analysis as you do here, and you find that it's, the phase difference is zero down here, and it very quickly goes up to pi by 2 on the other side of the cutoff. Okay? So there's a order one disagreement between these two things. So the conclusion is that the surface slope is not independently a new dynamical variable which oscillates out of phase with the concentration. It just isn't. It's in phase with it all the time. Okay, so we've been burying something in this whole discussion, which is what about what's going on inside the tube? Hey, you're only looking at the surface. What's going on inside? Everybody knows that there is radially segregated stuff going on inside. So maybe we can reinterpret the Aaronson-Simmering model and not think of this as the surface angle, but think of it as some variable which corresponds to something going on inside the tube to do with this radially segregated core. And maybe, for instance, the radially segregated core is oscillating out of phase with the surface slope in some way. And maybe that is the variable that gives you the oscillations. So in order to see this, Zena had a brilliant but simple idea, which is to shine a bright light through the thing, and I mean a really bright light. And the salt, which we use for the white particles, is translucent, and enough light scatters through that you can actually see a shadow of what's going on inside the tube. Now, it's not as good as looking at the surface where you can really image it precisely, but it's more than enough to see the width of what's going on inside the radially segregated core. So we take our camera, we point it at the surface, and we light it from behind, and we look at the shape of this shadow that we see on the surface here. And that tells us the width of the segregated core inside. Simultaneously, or actually alternating, we turn on a light bulb up here, turn off this one, and we can take a picture of the surface, just like we did before. So now we can make simultaneous movies of the surface color and the projected concentration, we call it. Now this should start after they load here. Okay, so this is a pre-segregated run again. The top one is this conventional thing where you see the surface. This is in a regime where there are oscillating waves, and they are damping down. So you saw the first one go down, and then if you really had good eyes, you see the second one come up between the first two. And here's the projected core, okay? Now, this is a little bit brighter than it should be, but anyway, you can see that bumps develop on the projected core, which line up with the stripes on the surface, and those bumps oscillate up and down. So here it'll do it again. Okay, so next develop between them. These bumps will go down, and new bumps will appear here, you see. And they will come and kind of poke close to the surface, then you'll see them here, and then they will go down, and a couple more oscillations will occur, but they're kind of hard to see because your eye is not so good at picking out these small concentration differences. Okay, so you get a few oscillations there. Okay, so what happens if we put this in space-time? Here is exactly the same kind of analysis as before. Here's the surface concentration, and here now is the width of the projected axial core. And I think you can see, again, this is sort of not perfectly resolved, but you can certainly see that as the oscillation occurs two or three times here, all the node lines line up in this case, too. Okay, conclusion, the surface concentration and the width of the also, of the axial core, of the radial core, are also in phase with each other, just like the surface slope is. Okay, so we have not identified a variable which is 90 degrees out of phase with the surface concentration. Okay, so I hate to break this to you, but we don't know the answer to this question, okay? The oscillatory axial segregation remains a mystery, okay? It's clear, I think, that a model like the Aaronson-Simmering-Wienerkur model, which is just a phenomenological exchange of amplitude between two diffusive variables which oscillates and mixes and all that stuff, is problematic because we don't know what the second variable is. We have no physical idea what it is, and we can't seem to identify it by looking inside the tube or at the surface or anything else. The segregation looks like a three-dimensional effect. The more you look at these projected things, you realize that it's really an oscillatory instability of the radial core. The stuff goes toward the radius, and then once it gets there, in some sense, it kind of oscillates up and down for a while before it settles down. And then it develops these bumps on the radial core which penetrate the surface, and it's those that you see as the surface bands, okay? So it's more of a three-dimensional problem than perhaps we had appreciated initially from just looking at the surface. So we've not identified what the out-of-phase field is analogous to theta in the ATV theory. We seem to have eliminated anything else that could be the obvious other field. For example, there could be subtle static charge effects, but we've done some tests which seem to eliminate that. And I sound hesitant because you can never prove an absolute negative, right? If there's anything that remembers where the grains were in the tube and oscillates out of phase, that would be a candidate for this other field. But we don't know what it is now. Okay, so what we did was we decided to return to the simplest questions you could ask about what's going on in this tube. And the idea was very simple. It was said, okay, everyone's been talking about diffusion in this tube. Is this tube really like diffusion? If you had a system in one dimension, you wanted to know whether it was diffusive, what do? You put in a delta function initial condition, and you see how it moves, right? That's simple. We've always talked about this as a diffusive process. Let's see if it really is. Okay, so we put in projection view, a small, narrow pulse of black, as narrow as we can make it. And this is in projection. You don't really see much on the surface anymore because this amount of black is so small that it goes right to the axis and you don't see it on the surface. So we're seeing it in projection here. The pulse quickly moves to the axis and it becomes subsurface, and then it slowly expands along the tube and it kind of looks a lot like diffusion. The question is this diffusion? Okay, I'm setting up for the answer, which is that it's not. Okay, so here's a space-time view of the same experiment. We start with a narrow pulse, and it spreads out, and the amplitude goes down, but you can see that it's spreading slowly in time. This is time going down. Here's a picture, a sequence of pictures of the width of that black thing as a function of time. This is right after 8 seconds after the start. It's approximately a delta function plus some broadening. As time goes on, that's about 200 seconds in pink, of 384 seconds in red, and then it's broadened right out at 1,000 seconds into this black lump here. There's some noise. So what we did was we did the simplest thing first, which is to study the growth of the width of this distribution in time. For normal diffusion, you would expect that width to scale like t to the 1/2. It does not. It, in fact, scales like t to the 0.36. And in fact, this is not a bad power law, actually. There's 3 decades of time here. 2.5, okay? And it's a pretty good power law, which shows you that it's kind of like diffusion, at least. It's not greatly different than a power law. But it's not the power law we've grown to love with normal diffusion. It's, in fact, subdiffusive because the power of the time is less than 1/2. So the axial transport in this system, which we've always, in all the models that I know of, have always assumed were something like diffusion, is something like diffusion, but it is not normal diffusion. So what is the subdiffusive axial transport? What does this mean? Now, I am not a mathematician, and you are, so you probably know, and I probably don't, but it's got something to do with this thing called the fractional diffusion equation, in which you take the ordinary good old diffusion equation, and you, like mathematicians like to do, you change something to an arbitrary variable, like the power of this time derivative. If you take alpha a half and beta equal 1, you get normal diffusion back. D is a positive constant. If beta is less than 1, then you get subdiffusion. Okay, the solutions to this thing are not, they grow more slowly than the solutions to a delta function pulse in the diffusion equation. They grow like t to some power, alpha, which is half of beta. Okay, so that's what we actually see. We see alpha of 0.3 whatever. And so you can sort of understand this because you get the same kind of subdiffusive behavior by taking a random walker, and you know you get the usual diffusion equation by taking equal times random steps left or right. That gives you the diffusion equation. If instead of taking equal steps left and right at equal times, you take them at random time intervals which are selected from a distribution which has a divergent mean, so there's some probability of hanging around for a long time at some location. Now, I failed to animate this for you. I was going to animate that little blue dot to run back and forth subdiffusively, but it was a little too much work, so I didn't do that. So you have to picture it doing that, okay? If you make a random walker who hangs around a long time, like some graduate students do, then you can show, and I can't show it, but some other people can show it, that you get a distribution of positions which obeys this subdiffusive equation and has, you know, alpha less than 1/2. And this kind of, in a crude way, makes physical sense because these grains are not just, you know, random walking up and down the tube. They're participating in a complicated round and round kind of flow while they're doing that, right? So in perpendicular plane to the direction we're looking at diffusion, stuff is in some sense trapped in little cycles, okay? And that's the sort of thing that might cause it to hang around longer than it would ordinarily as a random walker. And it sort of intuitively makes some sense that maybe the diffusion process is hindered by this process, and therefore it makes it subdiffusive. Okay, so we find, and we've not done this for large numbers of situations yet, but we're in the process of doing that, we find that this exponent, this thing that's less than a half, is roughly independent of the tube rotation frequency, if you scale it properly. And the next step, I think, is to take these distributions that I showed you back here. What we've done so far is look at the width of these things, how it scales with time. It doesn't matter how you define. You can take the half width, full width, and half maximum, or you can take any other well-defined width, because they all scale the same way with time. But what we should do, and this is what we really have to do to make this complete, is don't just take a width, but actually fit these things to the solution of the subdiffusion diffusion equation. Okay? And I think that's encouraging. This data is encouraging because one thing we know about subdiffusion is that unlike regular diffusion, which has a Gaussian profile, which has long exponential tails, the subdiffusion profile, if I'm not wrong, is of compact support, right? And it has kind of a rounded bump like that. It doesn't look Gaussian. And this pink one certainly does not look Gaussian, right? Okay, so there's some hope that this will fit the things. And then we will get, you know, all the parameters of the equation, including the diffusion constant, as well as the beta in the diffusion equation, without having to assume anything particular about the distribution. Okay, so that's the program. We haven't done that yet, but we're in the process of doing that. If anyone knows how to efficiently solve for that profile, please let us know. Okay, it's not trivial to fit something to that. Let me conclude by saying that I live here. You want to see it again? let me conclude by saying that I just live up the street, and you guys are here visiting, so please come and visit us. I couldn't think of anything better to do, but I suggest that we make a couple of times Sunday after lunch and Monday after lunch. Anybody who wants to come and visit the lab, there's actually lots of things going on besides the granular problems. If you just go out the back door of Fields just out here, and look for the big smokestack and go underneath the big smokestack, you will see in front of you the ugliest building in the world, which is the physics building. And if you go in that building down to the basement, room 090, which is in the north end, you will find our labs. And if you care to come on these two times, we'll give you a tour and show you all our experiments, and there's quite a few of them. And if you're interested in doing it virtually, you can visit our page here. And if you're here at the meeting or at the program for, you know, periods of months or whatever, you can just contact me or anybody in the group later on if you want to come for a tour. Thank you very much for your attention.